Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's a small country on the Horn of Africa, but it has a big presence in central Ohio. By some accounts, there are some 45,000 Somalis and Somali Americans living here, making it one of the largest Somali communities in the United States. Their homeland has been a hub of political unrest for decades. It's been without an effective central government since its dictator was overthrown in 1991. But just this week, the parliament elected a new president on its own soil, a sign of improving security. And then yesterday, tragedy, and at least five people were killed and three others wounded when two explosions were set off at the gate of the new president's temporary residence. The president is safe. Somalia is close to the heart of our guest today. Author Nuruddin Farah. He is one of the most celebrated authors in the world, and his work has garnered him international acclaim, accolades, and perhaps most importantly, the respect of his fellow countrymen. Nuruddin Farah is speaking tonight on the OSU campus as part of the 13th Annual Diversity Lecture and Cultural Arts Series at Ohio State. For more information, go to the link posted at our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You have written more than 10 books, garnered many awards, as I mentioned, and the most important awards. How did you come to work, to the work of writing, growing up in Somalia?
Well, I would say that I am luckier than most people. Luckier than most people in that I had an elder brother who was very interested in making me, born in a small town, growing up in a small town, what he was interested in making me was to see that the world in which we live in is a lot bigger and more varied than the one we had been born into. And so at the age of, for example, 4, I was sent to a Quranic school. At the age of 6, I was learning Amharic, which is the official Ethiopian language, Somali, Arabic, and English. And so by the time I was about 8 or 9, I was able to read in 2 or 3 languages. Obviously, I could not read in Somali because Somali had no script at that time. So the world in which I found myself in my preteens was one that was much, much bigger than the one my parents had known and about which they knew not only very little, but they were not even interested in. And that expanded my view, given me a much richer worldview because I went to school and learnt the Bible was a textbook in the school in the mornings, and in the afternoons the Quran was a textbook, which made me later, when I reached the age of 19, I was interested in studying, you know, for a degree in philosophy, in Hindu philosophy. And I went to India for that particular reason, because I just wanted to know how the world of the mind worked and what richness.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is the world-renowned Somali writer, Nuruddin Farah. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned that there was no script, no Somali script, when you were learning Somali. But you, obviously, you took to languages pretty easily, I would imagine. It's something of a gift.
Yeah, because, one never asked oneself a question. And if you come from a small country, like Somalia, or even if you come from Holland or Norway, small countries, people who belong in small countries learn many languages because they want to make their world big. People who come from America and speak English may never bother to learn another language because they think everybody should speak English anyway. So why bother with other languages? these are some of the benefits. I'm also luckier, you know, than many others, luckier, because, you know, boys and girls born the same year as I was, I would say about 90% of them are dead or inoperational. Why? Because, you know, when I was in my, before I was 10, lots of the children, my playmates died from small little things, you know, a mosquito bite, all kinds of things. So from this, I learned one thing that's very, very important, that having been spared, my life has been spared, there must be a purpose to it. Some people go religious and they devote their time more to praying and, you know, to devoting more time to building, you know, a kind of constructive bridge with religion and so on and so forth. I have taken that to mean that my life has been spared so that I could be of use to those who have survived, and not only survived, but who haven't had the same opportunities as I have, because I've lived in exile for many, many years, and the world received me with open arms. The world has been very kind to me. I lived in 15 countries other than my own. I've had my political troubles in some of the African countries, thrown out of one or, you know, threatened with imprisonment, and in Somalia, sentenced to death, and that sort of thing. But these are nothing compared to the responsibility.
You were exiled. You didn't choose to live outside of Somalia.
No, I did not.
There's a big distinction there, because you could have.
Well, if I had returned to Somalia, I could have ended up in prison.
Right.
Or I could have been, you know, as I said to you, I was sentenced to death for writing a book. So anything could have happened. But I thought, having, as I said to you, I saw myself as someone who should do something given the opportunity.
You, as mentioned, you take to other languages. You helped set up the first transliteration of the Somali language into the Western Latin alphabet. And before then, Somali idiom had existed only as a spoken language. Did that process change the language or how it's used in Somalia?
Well, it has. It has, in the sense that speaking a language is very different from writing it. If you had five Somalis sitting in a room like this, this is before 1972, October 1972, Somali had no orthography, no script. So if you had to write to me a letter in September, on September 30th, 1972, you would write a letter to me. One Somali would write a letter to somebody else, either in English or Arabic or Italian, but not in Somali. But when you met face to face, then you spoke Somali. So why should two Somalis find a foreign language as the medium through which to communicate? I mean, it was quite odd. One of the things I did was I wrote the first few chapters of a novel in Somali, the first, because Somali became a written language, as I said to you, in October 1972. By March, I was already publishing a chapter a week in the daily newspaper.
I was wondering, because I was going to ask, so you have a written language now, but who's using it?
Well, people are using it.
Did people embrace it immediately?
People embrace it immediately. And you would be amazed to know that when Somali became a written language, towards the end of October 1972, by the 1st of November, almost anyone who had learned foreign languages, and especially Italian and English. Mm-hmm. Anyone who could do that learned it in 2 days, or 3 days, because the only thing that's different is that certain guttural sounds, which we make, Somalis, mm-hmm. could not be written in the same way as English or Italian or European languages. So some form of coding had to occur, and letters representing different sound systems, especially the guttural ones, that people don't make in European languages. So you had it 2 days, and in fact, the policy at the time in 1972 was those who know must teach, and those who do not know must learn. And so everybody was learning it.
Your nemesis, you know, that went on for about 20 years, but your nemesis was General, correct me if I'm wrong, Mohamed Siad Barre.
That's correct.
Who took over Somalia in 1969. He ruled until 1991. You were eventually, as you mentioned earlier, exiled for your writings during his dictatorship. Tell us about the book that triggered your exile.
Well, there are two books, and in graded seriousness, if you want to call it. There's a novel, my second novel, called A Naked Needle, which has found to be very critical of the regime of Siad Barre, satirical in a way, and challenging, you know, taking the mickey, as they say in British English, which is, you know, teasing mm-hmm. the dictator. Dictators don't like being teased.
They usually don't have much of a sense of humor.
Exactly. And so there was a British newspaper called the Sunday Times, the London Sunday Times, which had, you know, provided a very good notice. The review said, this is one of the best satirical novels about Somalia. And you can have your laugh as you enjoy the reading of the novel or something like that. So the ambassador telegraphed Mogadishu and said, this is the greatest enemy the Somali revolution had to face. This is an enemy of Somalia and Somalis. And so I had no idea about this because the telegraph was, you know, from the ambassador to the...
Right.
And I arrived in Rome with a ticket to return to Somalia. I arrived on a Monday from Paris, on my way, after 2 years of studying theater in England, doing a postgraduate degree in theater. And my intention was to move into theater writing and produce plays in Somali. Mm-hmm. And here I am in Rome, and I called my brother in Mogadishu, and I said, I am taking the flight on Wednesday evening and arrive in Mogadishu Thursday morning. Could you arrange for someone to come and pick me up, please? And then he said, I advise you not to come. I advise you to stay until you hear from me. Because, he said, your news is not very good. When he called the next time he called the following day, he said, forget about Somalia. And the reason is because if you come, you have been promised a minimum of 30 years in prison for writing the novel called A Naked Needle. So between one instant and the following it, I became a man without a state. I could not return. I had to make the choice whether it was safe for me, and not only safe for me, but for my brothers and sisters. And the world is actually very, very small, because my brother, my older brother, who had sent me this message, was at that time working with a man who has recently been elected as a Speaker of Parliament. Hmm.
Just recently?
Just recently, about 10 days ago.
We're going to take a quick break. Once again, my guest is Nuruddin Farah. He is an acclaimed, world-renowned writer. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the U.S. ambassador to Libya was among four Americans killed late Tuesday in an attack on the American consulate in Benghazi. We'll look at what happened and why. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. 67 degrees, partly sunny skies with a high of 82 today. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 60. Some sunshine with a chance of rain on Friday. And cooler temperatures, a high of 71. Support for 89.7 comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, presenting Amy Grant in concert. Amy Grant has helped put contemporary Christian music on the map with achievements such as a platinum record and winning a Grammy. And she'll perform at the McCoy Center in New Albany on Sunday, October 7th. Tickets and details at mccoycenter.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Nuruddin Farah. He is an acclaimed Somali writer. He's a world-renowned writer. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You've said that you keep your country alive by writing about it. And I was wondering how watching events unfold from outside affected your topics and how you wrote.
Well, one of the things I say is that the idea of a nation is based on a hypothesis. And the hypothesis is that people agree, the people who belong to that nationality, agree that they are part and parcel of that integrated notion. I am a Somali, and I am a Somali as long as being a Somali is something agreeable to my instincts, to my pride, to my everything. And so when something terrible happens in the country in which you were born, to which you belong, you kind of feel first annoyed, then you feel averse to even mentioning that you come from Somalia. I remember in the days when terrible things were happening, every time terrible things happened in Somalia, many Somalis abroad would claim to be Sudanese or Ethiopian or something else. In the same way as Americans during the Vietnam War, some American pacifists would say they were Canadian, you know. That is one of the reasons why I thought I discovered that many, many Somalis, including my immediate brothers and sisters, did not want Somalia to be mentioned. The name became an abhorrence, something to take your distance from, some disgusting kind of thing. Because of this, and because nobody loved Somalia, nobody cared about it, I thought Somalia needed someone to love it, think about it day and night, eat it, imagine it continuing to live, and allow it to express itself. So I became the medium via which Somalia spoke to the rest of the world. And in the same way as I used to provide an alternative to the dictator's propaganda during the years when Siad Barre ruled the country, I wrote a dictatorship trilogy a trilogy, actually, negating everything that he had done and everything that he had said, proving, you see, his tyrannical nature and so on and so forth. I thought I should continue speaking on behalf of those who could not speak, because tyranny silences people, makes them other even to themselves. And that is why I was interested in claiming Somalia to be my own, because nobody else loved it. You know, if you find a child unhappy in a corner, when all the other children are playing hide and seek and other games, as a parent, as an adult, as a conscientious person, you go to them and you find out, what's the matter with you? What can I do for you? So Somalia became the pariah country, and I wanted to cleanse it and then readopt it and make it my own. Also because, unlike many people who stayed in Somalia until the beginning of the civil war, I had been denied the possibility of returning to Somalia. So I returned to Somalia. And whenever I returned to Somalia during the early years of the civil war, people went absolutely berserk, crazy. They would say, what's the matter with you? Are you mad? You're going to Somalia? They're going to kill you. They're going to eat you. Those are savages. And I recall in 1996.
These are your friends who weren't from Somalia?
No, Somalis.
Yeah, Somalis.
Somalis. Okay. Yeah. Immediate brothers and sisters. They said, you know, we worry about you. We worry about you. And then I remember in 1996, when I returned to Somalia after 22 years of exile, I remember sitting at a cafe when there was a war between the warlords going on less than half a kilometer away. I remember people coming and touching me and saying, how wonderful you are here. Because you are here, you justify our continued presence here. In other words,
we can keep fighting. It's worth fighting for.
Yeah. It's worth fighting for.
You've written many, many books. We've already talked about a few of them. But you've also written many plays. You mentioned you studied theater, but you won't let the plays be performed anywhere but Somalia.
Yes, I have actually revised that.
Okay.
Because now what I'm doing is I'm producing a play of mine in Minnesota in English.
Okay.
I mean, that's
where you're teaching right now.
But the idea is to, whatever productions I make of the plays will not be final. The text will not take its permanent form until after it's been translated in Somali and performed in Somalia.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Nuruddin Farah, Somali writer of great renown. If you have a question or comment for him, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So you've mentioned you've returned to Somalia many times now for visits. Will you ever live there again?
Well, it'll be difficult for some time. It'll be difficult because, well, the country is much, much smaller now than it used to be.
Smaller?
Smaller in terms of, you know, the number of... When I lived in Somalia for continuously a long time, I had thousands and thousands of friends. But more recently, whenever I have returned, there were fewer and fewer of the people that I knew still living in Somalia, because more and more Somalis have come out of the country. Some of them, blessedly, are here in Columbus, Ohio, some in Minneapolis, some in Toronto, and so on and so forth. To go and live in a country where there are no bookshops, where there is a dearth of cosmopolitanism, is going to be very, very difficult. Of course, now, more recently, you know, in the past 2-3 weeks,
right,
a great number of Somalis have returned, many of them wanting to become president or speaker of parliament or members of parliament and so on and so forth. But these are self-serving politicians, and I have, you know, I have my quarrel with many of them. I have my quarrel with many of them. But I should say, in parentheses, that above everything else, what has died in Somalia is the idea of cosmopolitanism. Hmm. The idea of cosmopolitanism was sacred in Somalia, sacred in that Mogadishu is the oldest city south of the Sahara. Mogadishu had ancient mosques and ancient traditions and communities that were not necessarily of Somali origin in the 9th century. So to think that now not only must you be a Somali, speaking Somali, because, as I said to you, in the 9th century, Somali was not the only language spoken there. It was a cosmopolitan city where you had Persians, Arabs, other people, Portuguese, mm-hmm. and many others. But to think that not only must you be a Somali or a Muslim, but you must also be of a given clan, that particular family clan, that is something I find quite abhorrent. And that is one of the reasons why it would be difficult for me to live in Somalia at present. There was a very, very rich cinema culture in Mogadishu. There were varieties, many different ways of looking at the world. People were not suffering from some form of myopia where they could blinkeredly see only the things that were very close to them and to their interests. That disturbs me, and therefore I may not be able to
live there.
To live there. I mean, I would even find Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, difficult to live in, because it doesn't have the features of Paris or London or Mogadishu of the 9th century. Mm-hmm. But if we could find a corner anywhere in Ohio where you have cosmopolitanism of some sort, which would allow differences of opinion, origin, ethnicity, nationality, and so on and so forth, then I would very much love to come and live.
Omar in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Omar.
Oh, yes. How are you doing, man?
Very well, thank you.
All right, I have a question for Mr. Farris. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well.
All right. I was wondering, how many ethnic groups do we have in Somalia? I'm from Guinea. We have almost about 16 different ethnic groups. And it brings some kind of problem. And I'm wondering if that's the kind of problem you guys are having in Somalia. Exactly what is the word based on? I mean, where the word is from? Is it the ethnic group or I don't think it's religious, but how many ethnic groups do you have?
Okay.
Well, unlike a great number of African countries, Somalia, what is very important in Somalia is the language Somali. That is a unifying force. The speaking of Somali language makes one a Somali. If you are born an Arab, or if you're born into a community which may have come 300 years ago from Tanzania or Mozambique or Kenya, it did not matter until the Civil War. You were a Somali as long as you spoke Somali as your mother tongue. So I would say we did not give importance to ethnicity. There is nowhere in the world where there are people with one ethnicity. Everywhere in the world, there are various varied people, people coming from varied sources, origins, who get together, and what unifies them, in my view, is the language. And Somali is the language that unified us. Somali with different intonations. So that...
Just like different accents?
Different accents, mm-hmm. and different uses of words. And then more lately, obviously, some people took the different intonational origins of Somali as meaning that they were different from the other people.
A way to separate. Hassan Sheikh Mohammed was elected by the parliament this week. I wondered what your thoughts are on the new president. Of course, there was some violence yesterday at his temporary residence, but he's okay. Is it a move in the right direction? Are you comfortable with where they're headed at this point?
Well, I was not comfortable with the way in which the members of parliament were elected. And the reason is because the members of parliament were elected on the basis that each of them belonged to and represented a given clan family. I do not believe that anyone can make the claim that he or she can represent a clan family. But this is obviously the second best, because the country has been through a civil war, a very fierce civil war, and because one has to find a way of unlocking politics so that we cease to glorify the gun and that we try and speak to each other face to face rather than use the gun to settle scores. So although I was very unhappy with the idea, because clanism not only differentiates between people who are one politically, but clanism also makes some camps, some families superior to others, you know, because in Somali we have not ethnicity, but we have a caste system very similar to the Indian caste system, a very abhorrent way of looking at the world. Two people looking the same, speaking the same language, but you believe one is superior to the other because of our ancestral differences. I've always opposed the idea of clanism because it allows some people to think that they are superior to the others. Not racism, but casteism. I have accepted that, but now that things are moving forward, as a temporary measure, I approve of what has happened. And I also know, I have known the man appointed as president. It's a very difficult job that he has. He strikes me as a very sensible man, and I hope he will remain sensible and that he will remain incorruptible. And the reason is because previous transitional presidents and prime ministers in Somalia have been very, very corrupt. He seems to be clean up to now. Mm-hmm. I hope that politics does not dirty him.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Acclaimed writer, acclaimed Somali writer, Nuruddin Farah, with us this hour. If you want to learn more about where he's appearing this evening, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. Coming up, We're going to talk about voting rights in the United States with the president of the League of Women Voters, the national president, Elizabeth McNamara. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, congratulating the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio by the Society of Professional Journalists for the third year in a row.
The first responding officers were confronted by lions, tigers, a grizzly bear.
She's a single mom with four children. She works as a part-time medical assistant. She makes only $1,300 a month.
Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and at our award-winning website, WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. 68 degrees, partly sunny skies, and a high of 82. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 60. Some sunshine with a chance of rain on Friday, and cooler, a high of 71. And clear skies for Friday night, and chilly, actually, a low of 47 degrees. Be sure to follow WOSU News on Twitter. Also like WOSU Public Media on Facebook for the latest from our award-winning news team. And support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners, investment managers, providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life, at sherringtongroup.com. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Turn on your TV and you are smacked with a campaign ad. As usual, they're getting nasty this time of year. In my opinion, they've been nasty all year. The closer we get to the general election, they'll get nastier, apparently.
When Mitt Romney and Bain closed the plan, I lost my health care. And my family lost their health care. And a short time after that, my wife became ill and admitted her for pneumonia, and that's when they found the cancer. And by then, it was stage four. There was nothing they could do for her. And she passed away in 22 days. I do not think Mitt Romney realizes what he's done to anyone.
It's not about people, it's politics. Solyndra's workers felt betrayed. Today, 90% of Solyndra's laid-off workers remain unemployed. $500 million in taxpayer money gone. And Obama said this was a model of jobs and growth.
Do you regret that?
No, I don't. Overall, it's doing well.
Tell President Obama American workers aren't pawns in your political games.
Those are a couple classics this season. What you don't hear in those ads, if you listen all the way to the end, is "I approved this message." Neither of these ads was produced by either the Romney or Obama campaigns. Welcome to the age of the super PAC, political action groups that can raise unlimited money from unlimited sources. But unlike traditional PACs, political action committees, they are banned from donating directly to political candidates. Joining me now to discuss this new generation of political funding and the ads that those funds can spawn and more is the president of the League of Women Voters, Elizabeth McNamara. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the OpenSecrets.org, a research group, says that 834 super PACs have reported taking in more than $349 million and spending more than $234 million this year. These are Republican and Democrat leading organizations and more. And that's just in a few years.
Absolutely. There is a flood of money coming into this election. There is no question about it. And the best response is a flood of voters turning out in November to express their opinion, to have their voice heard, and to get as much fact-based information to those voters as possible. And one very, very good source has been the political fact-checking, and the media has been a wonderful partner in helping voters get the right information. And the league is launching its Truth in Advertising campaign in an effort to continue to encourage that behavior and encourage the media, which has always been a great partner in making sure that voters have the facts, to not only fact check, but also to exercise as much control as possible over not the candidate ads, which they have to take as the candidates present them, but on these third-party ads, to screen them as much as possible and insist that they are accurate. And the media has the authority to do that.
Ultimately, a lot of people think the third-party ads aren't any much worse, if at all worse, than the candidates' ads themselves. The only thing that's really changed is that they're taking credit for it, the campaigns are, and it's difficult to know who's behind the third-party campaign ads. So ultimately, what is the difference? They're fact-checking PAC ads as well.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, and the media has been, you know, as I said, we're very pleased, and we certainly encourage the media to continue to fact check not just the third party ads, but also the candidate mm-hmm. ads. It is a great service that the media does for voters. There are sources, and we encourage voters to go to independent sources for facts, get as much information as possible before you go to the polls, and local television, local media, local radio, local newspapers are a wonderful source for that. And of course, in terms of the more fundamental, what do I need to go to vote? The League of Women Voters is providing vote411.org as a one-stop shopping for voters so that you can find the information. What are the voting laws in your state? What are the registration deadlines? What are the early voting dates? What do we need to bring with us to the polls? We're trying to create an environment where the voter has one web address that they can remember in order so that they feel confident that they have the information they need to go and vote this November.
We will post that website at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for my guest, she's Elizabeth McNamara. She's the national president of the League of Women Voters. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a call coming in from Sean in Columbus, wants to talk about the media. Sean, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. First, I got to say, I really like the work that the league does. I'm fully supportive of it. But I don't know where she's really getting the idea that the media is doing their job. I think as an observer of the media and a former journalist, they've kind of never been worse. They get things wrong far more than they used to, and there's always a rush to be first at the expense of actually getting things correct. I know there's some websites like factcheck.org and things like that that do a good job, but the mainstream media, I'm not seeing it, and especially when there's obviously partisan devoted entire networks that. We can probably don't need a name, but that just doesn't seem responsible at all.
Well, obviously the media, there's a wide variety of media out there, but there are organizations like Fact Check and FactCheck.org that do fact checking, and they do it for the media as well as for individuals. And there are political fact checkers that are available to voters both online and through many, many local newspapers. There is local media that is doing local television media that is also doing fact check. But this is, the media is part of our community as well. And part of the campaign that Fact Check and the League of Women Voters is conducting to try and do what we can to make sure that there is as much truth as we can legally get into these ad campaigns is to encourage individuals in the community to go to factcheck.org to look for the truth in campaign advertising or the Stand By Your Ad campaign. And contact your local media. Encourage them to do more fact-checking. As I said, they are an important, particularly in the local media, is a very important part of our community. And I do believe is interested in making sure that voters have the right information. They do need to hear from you, and there's no reason why they can't.
And, Sean, this isn't an excuse, but you could preface all of this by referring to it as the shrinking local media.
I would agree with that, most certainly. I mean, there's a lot of validity to that. And when I think of this problem, I think of it on a much more national scale than it previously was. And so I think, I think that's a huge problem. I don't think locally we see the problem nearly as bad as we do in a wide broadcast type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that looking at this election as an opportunity for communities to come together on all fronts, voters, the local media, is an extremely important message in this election. This is our opportunity to come together as a community, make important decisions for our families and for our futures, and including everyone in the community is what the League is all about.
Yeah, well, it's really important. And again, like they always say, politics is always local. But and you do a great job, so keep it up. And everybody needs to be active, I guess.
Thank you very much. I agree.
Thank you, Sean. Thanks for listening. The Ohio Supreme Court yesterday ruled that Republican-crafted language for state ballot issue 2 must be rewritten, and elements that were trimmed from the proposal by Republicans to redraw legislative and congressional districts must be returned to the ballot language in some form. That decision is the latest in a string of voting-related legal defeats for the Ohio Republican Party, as reported by the Columbus Dispatch this morning. Other rulings against them, provisional ballots and early voting. First of all, just from a national perspective, this has just been a constant drumbeat of problems regarding voting rights in the state of Ohio. Are other states sharing in these sorts of conflicts?
We have seen over the last 2 years a number of attempts in a variety of states for politicians to trying to manipulate the election laws for their own purposes. The League has been very, very active both in the state house and in courthouses around the country, trying to make sure that our election laws keep our elections the way Americans expect them to be: free, fair, and accessible to all eligible voters. Our concern with all of these attempts to manipulate the election process is that we are going to make it more difficult for eligible voters. And so we have been successful in a number of places, including here in Ohio, in either overturning or stopping these attempts. And that's why it is so important for voters to make sure that they have the correct information. It is getting confusing, but it doesn't have to be. That's why we launched vote411.org a number of years ago. It is more important in this election than ever because it will give you up-to-date information. And the League is available here in Ohio to provide information to voters to make sure that they know what they need, what to expect on Election Day.
When I had Secretary of State John Husted, Ohio Secretary of State John Husted, on the program a few weeks back when we were talking about the early voting issue, and since then a federal judge has stepped in and restored the voting the 3 days before Election Day, he talked about uniformity. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get at that issue of uniformity. Is uniformity equivalent to fair? So if every county has the same rules in Ohio, in a state like Ohio, which is, there's a lot of differences between the communities. Is uniformity a goal?
The goal is to make sure that the election is accessible to every eligible voter. The best way to ensure that is to make sure that our election laws provide as few barriers as possible to folks getting registered and getting out to vote, and that those laws, that the voters understand and know what those laws are. So the more uniform those laws are, the easier it is to get information to voters. But the important thing is to make sure that you do go out and vote. We realize that there's going to be confusion, but that we are asking voters, and we're hoping that voters will recognize what an important election this is. There are so many issues on the line and so many important decisions that your vote will help to make. And we need to support each other and come out and vote and make sure that our voices are heard. So, it's the important thing is making sure people have the information they need.
People often on the show, when they call in, will refer to the law in Oregon. It's all mail-in now in Oregon. It has been for some years now, and it's very successful, apparently. But I guess that's what I'm getting at is what good for Oregon necessarily good for a state like Ohio? And when you look at that panoramic view, is it necessarily the way it works?
You know, various states do, you know, handle their elections in different ways.
Right.
And I think every state, voters in every state, communities need to come together in every state and decide what is going to work well for them. Yes, mail-in voting has worked very well in Oregon. They have a huge voter turnout, something like over 80% on a regular basis.
Which is incredible.
Which is incredible, which is wonderful. I mean, clearly the issue all across the United States isn't ever that we have too many people registered and voting. It's that we don't have enough. But there is something that individual voters can do about that. And the most important thing they can do is, under whatever system they are operating, is to make sure that they turn out and vote and make sure their voice is heard. But clearly, that's a discussion that every community needs to have.
The back and forth that's been going on over all these different issues in Ohio, I was wondering, in your opinion, how much does something like that affect voters' motivation to get out and cast their ballot? Is it a big turnoff at a certain point?
Well, I'm certainly hoping not. And that's one of the reasons that I am here in Ohio and that I'm going to be traveling around to a number of other states, in states that have had challenges like Ohio, to make sure that voters know that they can, and it's that they should have the confidence to turn out and vote, and to try and raise awareness of how important it is. We have the greatest democracy in the world because every American, every citizen over the age of 18 is eligible to vote in this country. We need to bear that in mind, and we need to let nothing discourage us from going to the polls. There's a lot of money in this election. There is a lot of manipulation that has been attempted. It can't succeed as long as people turn out to vote.
Elizabeth McNamara, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Elizabeth McNamara, she is president and national president of the League of Women Voters. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.